The enemy often directed their shots at them in particular. In front of that barracks and other necessary places were parades and walks. The rest of the ground was soft mud. I've seen enemy shells fall upon it and sink so low that the report could not be heard when they burst, and I could only feel a tremulous motion of earth at the time. At other times, when they burst near the surface of the proud, they would throw the mud 50 feet into the air. The Diary of Private Joseph Plum Martin. In April of 1775, the British governor of Massachusetts, Thomas Gage, sent a group of British troopers to Concord, Massachusetts. Concord was the known post of a patriot arsenal. The troops had simple orders. First, they were supposed to capture both Sam Adams and John Hancock in Lexington. Next, they were to seize their weapons and gunpowder in Concord. When word got out that the British were about to go to Concord, the colonists acted. Two lanterns were hung in Boston's North Church. This was the signal patriots were waiting for. A lantern was to be hung if the British were to arrive by land, and two hung if the British came by sea. Paul Revere and other writers sounded the alarm, warning the Americans that the British were coming. The British soldiers ran into the Americans in Lexington, and the fighting officially began with what is considered to be the shot heard round the world. The Battle of Lexington and Concord marked the beginning of the war that would reshape the Americas forever and give birth to the new United States. The battles of Lexington and Concord would also serve as inspiration to colonists that revolution by ordinary citizens was possible. After the Battle of Lexington and Concord in 1775, the Second Continental Congress began meeting in Philadelphia to oversee the war effort. In general, the Second Continental Congress was a reconvened First Continental Congress, with many of the same original 56 delegates returning. Among some of the new delegates, including those from Georgia, who were absent from the First Congress, included Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania and John Hancock of Massachusetts. On June 14, 1775, the Second Continental Congress officially created the Continental Army and elected Washington as the supreme commander, in no small part because of his experience, but also because he had demonstrated an unprecedented loyalty and patriotism. Washington acted as supreme commander without pay. At this point, Congress also began to print money and appointed a standing committee to communicate with foreign governments should the need arise. America now had an official governing body. Despite not having proper military training and often being undersupplied, Washington, through sheer force of will, managed to lead the Continental Army through a number of key victories. Shortly after Washington was given control of the Continental Army, a major battle occurred. On June 16, 1775, a group of American soldiers started making their way to Bunker Hill so that they could take control of the Charleston Peninsula. The Americans got the orders a little confused and went to Breed's Hill instead, which happened to be very close to Bunker Hill. Although the British won this battle, it established a few things. For one, the Americans managed to kill or wound over 1,000 of the 2,300 soldiers that had been in the area. This proved that the Americans, though inexperienced, were willing to put up a great fight and did not mind taking down as many British as they could, even in defeat. It said a lot that a group of colonials had the ability and was willing to take on one of the most powerful armies in the world at the time. It also caused the king to issue a formal proclamation of rebellion, which stated that the British should treat the issue with the colonists as a foreign war. 1 month after the loss, the Second Continental Congress attempted to make peace with the British by sending over a proposal called the Olive Branch Petition, which asked the crown to revoke the Intolerable Acts. In exchange, the colonists would cease fire and end the war. Interestingly, the following day, Congress issued a declaration that outlined and justified the 13 colonies' decision to go to war. The king ultimately refused their petition and officially declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. December 23, 1776. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country, but he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered, yet we have this consolation with us that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. Britain, with an army to enforce her tyranny, has declared that she has a right not only to tax, but to bind us in all cases whatsoever. Even the expression is impious, for so unlimited a power can belong only to God. Thomas Paine, The American Crisis. While there were true soldiers in his congregation, Washington did his best to recruit from the countryside as well. It was the Prussian commander, Frederick Wilhelm von Steuben, Baron von Steuben, from one of his previous campaigns that assumed the role of training them. Von Steuben was considered one of the fathers of the Continental Army and was responsible for bringing a formal style of training to the mostly untrained group. Interestingly, when von Steuben first arrived in New Hampshire in 1777, he and his crew were almost shot and arrested. Von Steuben had mistakenly outfitted his aides in red uniforms, and the Americans thought they were British soldiers. After the Battle of Lexington and Concord, there was a period between 1775 and 1776 known as the Siege of Boston. During this phase of the war, the Americans blocked off land access to Boston, which occupied a peninsula. This limited the British to only what resources they could obtain by sea, which crippled the British forces. It was during this time period that the Battle of Bunker Hill and the Battle of Chelsea Creek were fought. Ultimately, after 11 months, the British were forced to retreat, and it was considered a colonial victory. There were a number of losses, but despite it all, Washington never once retreated or surrendered, and his sense of pride in his generals and soldiers was legendary. One of these defeats happened to be at New York and resulted in huge losses for the Continental Army. A major turning point in the war occurred at the Battle of Saratoga in 1777. The battle occurred after a very harsh winter where troops camped miserably in Valley Forge. In this battle, over 5,000 British, German, and Loyalist troops surrendered to American forces, which reignited the revolutionary spirit. Also, the battle convinced the French that they should align themselves with the Americans. In 1781, another major event occurred that helped seal the deal for Americans. With the help of their French allies, the colonists were able to successfully blockade British ships from delivering supplies to their troops in Chesapeake Bay, which led to the surrender of 8,000 British troops. The siege of Yorktown caused the British people to start demanding a truce be made. 6 years after Washington officially took the reins as commander-in-chief, the ragtag group of colonial rebels made the British forces surrender and allow the colonies to declare their independence. The final and eventual peace came in 1783 when Britain signed the Treaty of Paris, a document that would grant the United States its independence from British rule and establish it as its own country. Originally, America conducted negotiations through France and Spain. The first treaty, known as the American Treaty, would confine American territory to east of the Appalachian Mountains and would have given Britain control over land north of the Ohio River, with land south of the Ohio River becoming an Indian buffer state. The Americans quickly realized that they could get a better deal by negotiating directly with the British, and serious talks began. The Treaty of Paris also granted the United States territories east of the Mississippi River, north of Florida, and south of Canada, creating an almost identical northern border to what exists today. For Washington, the war was over. Though he planned to return to his quiet life, history had other plans for him. In 1789, he was called out of his retirement by the Electoral College and officially elected as the first President of the United States. It is interesting to note that they initially offered to pay him a salary equal to around $350,000 today. Washington, although suffering financial troubles from his failing farm and homestead, actually rejected the offer at first. However, he soon accepted it again. Not so much because he needed the money, but because he did not want to set a precedent for limiting the presidency only to those who were already wealthy enough. He also requested that people simply call him Mr. President, the most humble of the possible titles that had been conjured up by the Electoral College. Washington's presidency was unique for many reasons, including the fact that he never resided in Washington, D.C. Washington kept houses in New York and Pennsylvania, which were used to receive members of Congress, foreign dignitaries, and others requesting an official visit. He did oversee the development of a federal district along the Potomac River, which began after Congress passed the Residence Act in 1791. The Residence Act specified that a permanent seat of government be established in what is now Washington, D.C. Washington also established several precedents still in place today. He established a cabinet of advisors, though Washington's cabinet only included 4 members. Today's cabinet is 16 members. Those first cabinet advisors were Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State, Alexander Hamilton as Secretary of Treasury, Henry Knox as Secretary of War, and Edmund Randolph as Attorney General. Washington also chose to surround himself with people who had differing viewpoints on government philosophy. He liked to have diversity in his advisors. Before he retired as president, Washington crafted one of his more endearing and famous documents, his farewell address. It listed out, among other things, his hopes for the United States. He was an avid advocate of republicanism and actually feared the creation of a multi-party system of government, which he thought might weaken the Union. One of the most lingering and influential aspects was probably his take on foreign policy, in which he took an insulator stance, thinking that it was not the place of Americans to interfere or get involved with the issues of other countries, and that they should only focus on American interests and activities.
Friends and citizens, the period for a new election of a citizen to administer the executive government of the United States being not far distant, and the time actually arrived when your thoughts must be employed in designating the person who is to be clothed with that important trust, it appears to me proper, especially as it may conduce to a more distinct expression of the public voice, that I should now apprise you of the resolution I have formed to decline being considered among the number of those out of whom a choice is to be made. Toward the preservation of your government and the permanence of your present happy state, it is requisite not only that you steadily discountenance irregular oppositions to its acknowledged authority, but also that you resist with care the spirit of innovation upon its principles, however specious the pretext. One method of assault may be to effect, in the forms of the Constitution, alterations which will impair the energy of the system, and thus to undermine what cannot be directly overthrown. In all the changes to which you may be invited, remember that time and habit are at least as necessary to fix the true character of government as of other human institutions. That experience is the surest standard by which to test the real tendency of the existing constitution of a country. That facility in changes, upon the credit of mere hypothesis and opinion, exposes to perpetual change from the endless variety of hypothesis and opinion. And remember, especially, that for the efficient management of your common interest in a country so extensive as ours, a government of as much vigor as is consistent with the perfect securing of liberty is indispensable. Liberty itself will find in such a government, with powers properly distributed and adjusted, its surest guardian. It is, indeed, little else than a name where the government is too feeble to withstand the enterprises of faction, to confine each member of the society within the limits prescribed by the laws, and to maintain all in the secure and tranquil enjoyment of the rights of person and property. George Washington, Farewell Address. Fun fact. Although quite a number of history books mention this fact, George Washington's teeth were not really made of wood. For one thing, wood teeth would not have been very durable. The truth is, Washington's dentures were made of hippopotamus ivory. Sometimes the teeth of pigs and monkeys were also used, and they were set in lead. Washington's dentures were said to be so uncomfortable that he had to resort to applying an opium-based liniment on his cheeks so he could bear the pain. The Founding Fathers and the Declaration of Independence. In the summer of 1776, delegates from each of the original 13 colonies, also known as the Second Continental Congress, gathered in Philadelphia. The goal of the group was to decide whether it was the right time for the colonies to secede from England. The past year had been an incredibly hard one for the young United States, as they had been constantly battling the much better equipped and trained British redcoats. But somehow the tides turned in their favor, and they forced the colonizers to retreat. Richard Henry Lee, the delegate from Virginia and former president of the Continental Congress, was the first to propose a resolution of independence. The Lee Resolution is the earliest known draft of what would become the Declaration of Independence. The resolution stated that the United Colonies was no longer under the rule of the British, and that any and all allegiances with the British Crown were to be immediately dissolved. The Committee of Five. During the drafting period of the Declaration, not all of the delegates had the authority to vote on what went into the document, as their states hadn't given them the power to do so. While they were still figuring things out, the Continental Congress appointed a committee consisting of the five most brilliant minds in the nation: Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston. At first, the delegates wanted Richard Henry Lee to draft the Declaration of Independence. However, certain events happened that prevented Lee from penning what would have been the single most important document in American history. Fortunately, a young delegate from Virginia by the name of Thomas Jefferson was up to the task. Initially, Jefferson wanted John Adams to write the Declaration, but when the latter refused, Jefferson forced himself to do the task. Because this was taking place in the wake of a newly found independence, it was a period of liminal political movements. Basically, there were still many citizens who, through professing their love for their independence, still held shaky and tenuous allegiances and loyalties to the king. The Declaration of Independence thus included a number of paragraphs and entries that attempted to further separate the United States from its British founder. In particular, a right to revolution. While a number of colonists hoped that they would eventually be able to reconcile with Europe and the British monarchy, it was clear to the Patriots and the Committee of Five that this was an opportunity to truly grasp their liberation once and for all. The Committee of Five worked tirelessly for almost a month until, on June 28, 1776, they published the final draft of the Declaration of Independence and presented it to Congress. It is interesting to note, and a testament to the integrity of the Founding Fathers, that the document actually contained no new information or ideas. It consisted primarily in its final draft of ideas and thoughts and principles that had all been widely exercised and held dear during the American Revolution, one of the primary ones being a sense of oppression from Britain, and especially King George, who was seen as having undermined the God-given rights of the colonists. Some of the later effects of the Declaration of Independence would surface in the form of a controversial take on slavery. One of the most famous passages, that all men are born equal, has often been taken to insist that Jefferson was condemning the British act of slavery. And in fact, a number of paragraphs that further admonished Britain for it were eventually deleted from the final document. While this has been proved to be historically accurate, the real irony is that Jefferson himself was a prominent slave owner with hundreds of indentured slaves under his control. Whatever the intent, the Declaration of Independence would eventually serve as a banner for future abolitionists. One of the most famous and iconic being, of course, Abraham Lincoln. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of this earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Excerpt from the Declaration of Independence. Fun fact. The Continental Congress officially adopted the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. But the Founding Fathers did not get a chance to sign it until the good part of a month had passed by. Additionally, one of those signers, John Hancock, whose very elegant signature appeared on the document, became embedded in the cultural milieu of the United States, and today the word Hancock is synonymous with someone's signature. Here's another lesser-known fact. One signer of the Declaration, Richard Stockton, recanted his signature on the document and withdrew his support from the Revolution. However, this was not done willingly. On November 30, 1776, just months after the signing of the Declaration, British troops captured Stockton and threw him into prison. His captors convinced Stockton to rescind from the Revolution by limiting his food rations and torturing him until he swore his allegiance to King George III. Misconceptions. Betsy Ross designed the first American flag. The role that flag seamstress Betsy Ross had in the design of the American flag was not presented until 1870, almost a century after George Washington apparently made his request that she make it. Ross's grandson told a tale which has not yet been proven by research. It is possible that credit could go to several other seamstresses, Margaret Manning, Cornelia Bridges, or Rebecca Young, whose daughter sewed the flag that inspired Francis Scott Key, composer of the Star-Spangled Banner, the national anthem. The British Are Coming. Popular culture, in part due to the popularity of Wadsworth's poem, The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, boasts several legends regarding the patriot. It is said that he rode through the town on horseback, crying a warning of, "The British are coming! The British are coming!" This would not have happened. For one, most colonials at the time considered themselves to be British. Secondly, British troops were scattered throughout the area. It wouldn't have been prudent to draw the attention of the regulars. The United States Constitution. Although the original United States Constitution came into effect way back in 1789, we include it here as one of the last chapters because it has been a continually changing and organic document, and a pivotal instrument in terms of the way it's shaped the United States up to present day. The Constitution experienced its first draft way back during the beginning of the Americas, when the country was still new and the provisional government still in the process of attempting to put together a system of laws and government that would last for centuries. The country's first attempt at having some type of stability can be found in the Articles of Confederation. The purpose of the document was to properly outline what kind of powers the delegates would have. The Articles of Confederation was formally ratified by all 13 states in 1781, giving the newly declared United States its first outline of a constitutional government. As we mentioned earlier in this book, the Iroquois Confederacy had a version of a centralized government with an outline of how the government should be run, and Benjamin Franklin had contact with the Iroquois Nation. It stands to reason, then, that the Six Nations had some influence on the founding documents of the country, including the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation was a good idea, but it ultimately did not allow for enough power within the central government. The Articles called for a unicameral Congress, no president, and a lot of rights given to the individual states. Unfortunately, the Articles of Confederation did not last long. In response to a whiskey tax, Daniel Shea and a group of farmers led a rebellion against an arsenal in Massachusetts. The encounter was fairly violent and embarrassing because of how difficult it was to control the situation. Shea's rebellion proved that the Articles were not able to withstand on their own and that a major change had to occur. It wasn't until 1788 that the Constitution, in its more or less complete form, was finally submitted to Congress, who were responsible for the very long and wearisome process of ratification. The Articles of Confederation, formerly known as the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, was ultimately superseded by the United States Constitution, which was ratified in 1788 and effectively created a new government in 1789. One of the major constituent articles of the Constitution was based on the Magna Carta and strove to give rights to everyone in America as citizens. There was also, according to both Locke and Hobbes, popular philosophers and social critics of the age, several provisions put in, and these became the backbone of the Constitution and indeed the overall American sense of nationalism. These happen to fall into three categories of a social contract that the government was supposed to protect: the basic rights to life, liberty, and freedom. Then, in 1791, another set of 10 laws were added, and these included the Bill of Rights, which were further guarantees for all members of the U.S. that helped to stabilize a sort of moral compass in the populace. Article 1 in the Constitution described what the Congress would be in the United States and all the other legislative branches, and set down a list of responsibilities and rules for them to follow. Article 2 involved paragraphs that were designed to give the president the power of the military strength of his nation and militia, and has been a staple of policy ever since. This is something that is often brought up in American politics and elections through the idea that the president has his or her finger on the launch codes, referring to the capacity for a president to control the nuclear arsenal. This article primarily deals with the office of the president and contains provisions related to what happens if the president is impeached. Article 3 has to do with the court system and lists out ad nauseum all the different laws associated with jurisdiction. It is interesting to note that this article also contains the definition of treason and how to handle it, and that treasonous thoughts alone are not an indictable offense, but must include overt action. Article 4 is all about how states get along with other states and how legislated state laws and federal laws interact with one another. This was important because one clause prevents the federal government from favoring one state over another and makes it so that all states have to be regarded equally in the eyes of the government. It also included clauses about extradition from one state to another, although this is not much of an issue these days. Even though states do have their own laws, in earlier times, crossing from one state to another was a costly and bureaucratic nightmare. Article 5 is a very important element because it outlines the process for attempting to amend the Constitution. This is of note because, as we've seen, the Constitution is a very fluid and dynamic document that has changed over the years to reflect the common values and principles of each age. This is a vital factor not only in the process of democracy, but also in helping to modernize our approach to living. Laws that do not make sense or harm the values of the U.S., such as prohibition, are capable of being repealed. And it is this flexibility that has helped to shape the U.S. into what it is today. As a side note, it should also be observed that Article 4 is what allows Congress to pass new amendments. In 1808, when it first had the power to do so, it attempted to legislate ratification for a ban on slavery, a decision that helped to establish the American ideal of liberty. Article 6, the last one in the Constitution, outlines the process and rules related to the outline of creating their new kind of government. One has to remember that before the United States was truly united, there were a number of states, especially in the South, that resisted integration into the grand design of the United States of America, and Article 6 was crafted in such a way as to bring these states into the fold. James Madison proposed 9 articles with which to amend the Constitution. 7 of those would become part of the Bill of Rights. In 1789, Congress had approved 12 articles of amendment to the Constitution. Of those 12, Article 2 would not become ratified until 1992 as the 27th Amendment, which prohibits congressional salaries from changing until after the next election. Article 1 was never ratified, but would have set a permanent apportionment rate that would determine the district population size for the House of Representatives. The Bill of Rights was added to the Constitution in 1791 and outlined what the Founding Fathers believed were the rights of all free citizens. These 10 amendments are collectively known as the Bill of Rights. Many of these amendments may sound familiar to you, as many originate in the reasons that colonists first came to the New World or the grievances that Americans had with their British rulers. The First Amendment states that citizens have the right to free speech and to practice religion freely. The amendment also states that there should be no prohibiting the press or the right to assemble and protest. The Second Amendment is somewhat controversial in modern America as it states that Americans have the right to bear arms, which some interpret liberally and others rather conservatively. There are opponents who argue that there should be some restriction to gun ownership given modern gun standards, while others argue that any restriction on gun ownership is unconstitutional. The Third Amendment prohibits the ability to quarter soldiers without the consent of the owner, which is a departure from the British laws that required Americans to provide quarters for the British military should the need arise. Interestingly, this is the only amendment of the Bill of Rights that has never been challenged or brought up for discussion in the Supreme Court. The Fourth Amendment protects persons against unreasonable search and seizure and also requires that warrants may only be issued upon probable cause. The Fifth Amendment protects against self-incrimination and double jeopardy and also guarantees the right to due process. Defendants in criminal cases are protected by the Sixth Amendment and are guaranteed a right to a fair and speedy trial, a trial by an impartial jury, and the right to legal representation. Related to that, the Seventh Amendment outlines the right to a jury trial in federal civil cases. The Eighth Amendment protects citizens against excessive bails or fines, as well as protection against cruel and unusual punishments. The Ninth Amendment is interesting and has contributed to many Supreme Court decisions. The amendment states that not all rights and liberties are explicitly outlined in the Constitution. Just because something is not an explicitly stated right does not mean that those inherent rights should be insecure. The Ninth Amendment was used as the foundation of several major Supreme Court cases, including Roe v. Wade. The Tenth Amendment outlines and reinforces the separation of powers, stating that any powers not given to the federal government by the Constitution and not prohibited on the states shall be reserved for the individual states. The Bill of Rights, full text. Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or in the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Amendment 3. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house, without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in manner to be prescribed by law. Amendment 4. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Amendment 5. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Amendment 6. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Amendment 7. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Amendment 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Amendment 9. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Amendment 10. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The Constitution has had 27 amendments made to it since its inception, and, other than the Bill of Rights, these include safeguards of liberty and justice designed to ensure that the federal government would assist states in trouble, other bills guaranteeing rights and privileges, and a number of safeguards to civil rights. The most recent amendment, number 27, came about in 1992 to prevent members of Congress from giving themselves pay raises during a term of service. While the Constitution stands as a blazing example of contemporary democratic thought, there have been a number of criticisms leveled at it, the first being that in its original form it did not specify who and who did not have the right to vote. This would become an issue later down the road during the civil rights movement and women's suffrage movements, when black minorities and women's groups rose up and demanded the ability to vote and participate in the political affairs of the United States. Both periods were very difficult, especially for minorities, because men had dominated the powerful roles up until then. Their eventual success in not only getting the right to vote, but laying the foundation for increased representation across the board has continued to this day and acts as a reminder of the American spirit to endure, and that we still have a long way to go before we can say we are truly a country of equals. This era will be discussed in more detail in the next chapter. While only 27 amendments have been passed and officially ratified and recognized, there are a number of amendments that are still pending, some going as far back as 1922, including a child labor law that would limit and restrict jobs for those under 18 years of age. A number of other amendments were put forward but rejected, the most prominent being the Equal Rights Amendment of 1972. Had it been passed, it would have prohibited discrimination and deprivation of rights by the state or federal institution based on sex. Unfortunately, the proposal failed by just 3 votes and was never brought forward again. Another interesting one that failed was a proposal to give the District of Columbia the ability to vote and have full representation in the Senate, effectively making it another state. Misconceptions. The Lost Founding Father. George Mason of Virginia was actually the main champion for creating the Bill of Rights. Mason helped draft the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which included the phrase that all men are by nature free and independent and have certain inherent rights, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty. Thomas Jefferson used these words as clear inspiration for the Declaration of Independence. When the Constitutional Convention was meeting, Mason insisted that a Bill of Rights be included, which was originally rejected by the state delegates. Mason refused to sign the original Constitution without this element. Not all states ratified the Bill of Rights. 3 states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Georgia, did not fully ratify the Bill of Rights until its 150th anniversary in 1939. The states, for a variety of reasons, ratified some, but not all, amendments to the Constitution. Can you believe this actually happened? How many amendments were proposed for the original Constitution? A. 19. B. 10. C. 50. D. 12. Answer. 19. James Madison originally presented 19 amendments to the Constitution. The House of Representatives approved 17, and the process moved to the Senate. The Senate reduced the number of amendments to 12, and eventually 10 were approved and created the first 10 amendments known as the Bill of Rights. What amendment has never been broached at the Supreme Court? A. The 1st. B. The 10th. C. The 3rd. D. The 5th. Answer. The 3rd. The 3rd Amendment prohibits soldiers from staying in your home without your consent made sense in the 1700s when the amendment was conceived, but has never been cited by the Supreme Court for a decision. How many states originally ratified the Constitution? A. 7. B. 13. C. 11. Or D. 9. Answer. 9. Only 9 states needed to ratify the Constitution to pass, and 9 states approved by 1788. All states eventually ratified the Constitution, but not immediately. Did Thomas Jefferson sign the Constitution? A. Yes. B. No. Answer. No. Founding Father Thomas Jefferson's signature was notably absent from the Constitution. He was representing the U.S. abroad in France at the time. If the choice were yours, do you think it's important to include a list of inalienable rights? Not everyone did. There were quite a few delegates that did not believe it was important to include a list of rights in the Constitution. The original Constitution, created by the Constitutional Convention in 1787, did not include the Bill of Rights. Some delegates needed convincing by heavy hitters such as Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and James Madison. History has its eyes on us today. The Bill of Rights has stood as the backbone of legal decisions since its inception. Some amendments are cited often and are even controversial, while others simply establish the rule of government and the powers given to the branches of legislature. There are some amendments that are controversial, even in the modern era. The Second Amendment to the Constitution, in addition to establishing the powers of the president, also declares that citizens have a right to bear arms. This right has been hotly debated, with proponents arguing that to bear arms means that citizens have a right to own any gun, while opponents say that this right should be restricted to guns of a certain type, this allowing guns like automatic and semi-automatic weapons. There is also a debate as to how people should be allowed to acquire guns, and many states have developed their own laws on gun restriction and ownership. Chapter 3. Westward Expansion. A Half Century of Expansion, 1803 to 1853. Following the American Revolution, the colonies became their own power. The territorial expansion of the newly formed nation was greater than any of the old powers in Europe, except Russia. However, the United States had a lot of growing to do before it became the continent-spanning nation that it is today. Between the American Revolution and the American Civil War, the United States expanded its area from the East Coast colonies all the way across the continent to California, coming into conflict with the claims still laid by the old European powers. Louisiana Purchase. Not long after the Revolutionary War, the United States was presented with the opportunity to purchase a huge swath of land that stretched from Montana to Louisiana from the French. The purchase effectively doubled the land area of the United States and gave the new country a wealth of natural resources. Jefferson wanted control of New Orleans, a French city, because it was at the mouth of the Mississippi River. This would give American farmers from inland a better route to transport goods either to Europe or to the East Coast, where the majority of the population lived. Jefferson's first offer to purchase the city was rejected, but when he made another offer, this one 5 times the original, it was accepted. France even offered to sell the rest of the territory for just a 50% premium. France sold New Orleans for $10 million and the other 828,000 square miles of the territory for another $5 million. Napoleon needed the money for his wars and, of course, to fight Britain. The French had also recently regained control of the area from Spain, which they had previously ceded as a result of the Seven Years' War. This reestablished control was worrying to the nascent United States because France was now resurgent under Napoleon, and American farmers in the Ohio River Valley relied on access to the Mississippi River and New Orleans. However, Napoleon was willing to give up the territory, which cost France a significant amount to maintain for the equivalent of $15 billion. This marked the end of any sort of French colonial power in the United States, and it is widely regarded as one of the most extreme geopolitical blunders in modern history. Shortly after making the purchase of the territory, President Jefferson asked Meriwether Lewis to go and explore the land. Lewis, along with his longtime friend William Clark, started the expedition in May of 1804. Their group,
the Corps of Discovery managed to deal with illness, hunger, famine, and fatigue throughout their journey exploring this newly acquired area of the United States. Lewis and Clark Expedition. Shortly after Jefferson orchestrated the purchase of the Louisiana Territory from France, he commissioned an expedition with the intention of exploring, mapping, and documenting the area, primarily in hopes of finding an easy path to the western part of the newly expanded country. Jefferson employed Captain Meriwether Lewis and his friend Second Lieutenant William Clark. The duo was also joined by a small group of volunteers from the U.S. Army. This became known as the Lewis and Clark Expedition, or the Corps of Discovery Expedition. No American had ever explored these areas to the west, so the two-year trek from 1804 to 1806 was long and perilous. Britain had already declared that they wanted to take control of fur trading routes along the Columbia River, so the goal was to lay claim to the western lands on behalf of America before the British or the French could make any territorial claims. There were also scientific and economic goals. Thomas Jefferson, a self-proclaimed scientist, was passionate about the pursuit of knowledge and wanted the expedition to not only document the route west, but also local plants, animals, and geographic features. The secondary goal was to establish economic trade with the Native American tribes. The Corps of Discovery was trained in wilderness medicine, navigation, and basic sciences before leaving on their journey, and the team was to map a direct water-based course to get to the Pacific. The 33-member crew departed from Missouri in 1804 and began their journey west. Only one member of the Corps of Discovery died during their journey, Sergeant Charles Floyd, who died of appendicitis. If it weren't for the positive relationships the Corps built with Native American tribes along the way, this number surely would have been much higher, as they were surrounded constantly by threats of exposure and starvation. By the time the crew reached present-day North Dakota, they had almost had several conflicts with Native groups, including the Sioux. The Corps was in the Mandan Territory when they met a French-Canadian fur trapper named Toussaint Charbonneau and his Shoshone wife, Sacajawea. Sacajawea proved invaluable for the traveling party. Charbonneau and Sacajawea spoke three languages and acted as translators for various Native American groups they encountered. Sacajawea spent much of her time gathering edible plants and medicinals. One time when the boat she was in almost capsized, Sacajawea recovered valuable papers and supplies that would otherwise have inevitably been lost. In his journal, Lewis wrote that the boat contained almost every article indispensably necessary to further their views or ensure the success of the enterprise. She kept a calm disposition during the storm that rocked the boat, unlike her husband, who had a tendency to panic. After the incident, Lewis wrote, "The Indian woman to whom I ascribe equal fortitude and resolution with any person on board at the time of the accident caught and preserved most of the light articles which were washed overboard." In addition to her calm demeanor and translation skills, she had value in simply being a woman. Sacajawea and Charbonneau had a son, Jean-Baptiste. When Indians saw a woman and child traveling with a group of white men, they believed it was unlikely that they were bearing warlike intentions. Some groups of Indians had never encountered white people before and were prepared to defend their land from outside threats. Having Sacajawea as part of the Corps of Discovery potentially saved them from serious conflict. On November 5, 1805, the Corps of Discovery first spotted the Pacific Ocean. They reached it 2 weeks later. Their team was short on supplies and opportunities for hunting in the area were sparse. The area near the Columbia River where they originally set up camp was prone to storms and would leave the crew faced with a perilous winter. The team voted as a group on whether to remain at their current location or move to a better location. All members of the party, including Sacajawea and Clark's slave York, had an equal vote in whether to stay or go. Ultimately, the team moved to a location close to modern-day Astoria, Oregon, and established Fort Clatstop as not only a winter shelter, but as the official statement that America had claimed to land as far as the Pacific Ocean. Interestingly, the expedition of Lewis and Clark was largely forgotten by the mid to late 1800s, and interest in the team was only revived with the 1904 Louisiana Purchase Exposition, celebrating Lewis and Clark as American pioneers.
Today, Lewis and Clark are known as some of the most famous and recognizable explorers in American history. Through the Eyes of an Eyewitness. September 3, 1803. Very foggy this morning. Thermometer 63 degrees Fahrenheit. Immersed the thermometer in the river, and the mercury rose immediately to 75 degrees. Summer heat so that there is 12-degree difference is sufficient to shew the vapor which arises from the water. The fog this produced is impenetrably thick at this moment. We were in consequence obliged to lie by until 9 this morning. Mr. Guy Bryant arrived with 2 boats loaded with furs. He informs me that if I can reach and get over the Georgetown bar 24 miles, I can get on. This is some consolation. We set out at 9 this morning and passed a riffle just below us called Atkins. Got over with tolerable ease, passed the mouth of Big Beaver Creek, and came to anchor off McIntosh, being 2.5 miles. Discharged one of my hands. Passed the riffle below McIntosh. About 3 miles from this, we stuck on another riffle. The worst, I think, we have yet passed were obliged to unload and drag over with horses. Stayed all night, having made only 6 miles. Meriwether Lewis from the Journals of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. The War of 1812. Britain was actively engaged in the Napoleonic Wars with France at the onset of the 19th century, and both sides attempted to manipulate trade agreements with the United States in an effort to prevent the other side from receiving supplies. The British Royal Navy also began to practice impressment on the U.S., which took American seamen off of U.S. merchant vessels and forced them into service aboard British ships. At this point, there were many Americans pushing for war with Britain due to Britain's maritime violations, as well as the fact that Britain had been encouraging Native American hostility against American expansion. Essentially, there were 3 theaters of war: the Atlantic Theater, the Southern Theater, and the Great Lakes and Western Territories. The massive Royal Navy placed a blockade on points along the Atlantic coast and performed raids that offered enslaved blacks a chance for freedom aboard British ships. The Atlantic Theater was also hallmarked by the siege on the Capitol. The British forces burned the Executive Mansion, now called the White House, while President Madison retreated further into Virginia. Battles also waged in the Northwest Territory and along the Canadian border, a British territory. The U.S. made 3 failed attempts to enter Canada, but the Canadian militia was well-trained and came out on top in defending their territory. There was yet a 3rd region in the south and along the Gulf Coast where battles were fought. The Battle of New Orleans was significant in that this was the final major battle of the war. In a time during which news traveled comparatively slowly, troops on both sides did not yet realize that the Treaty of Ghent had been signed and that the war between the Americans and the British was technically over. With neither side in the Gulf region aware of this, the Battle of New Orleans began 2 weeks after the treaty was signed. There were devastating casualties on both sides, but America came out of the battle a victor, led by Major General and future President Andrew Jackson. It was during this war, the Battle of Chesapeake Bay specifically, that Francis Scott Key wrote the poem, The Defense of Fort McHenry, which provided the lyrical basis for what became the U.S. national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. O say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming. And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. O say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? On the shore dimly seen through the mist of the deep, where the foe's haughty host in dread silence reposes, what is that which the breeze o'er the towering steep, as it fitfully blows, half conceals, half discloses? Now it catches the gleam of the morning's first beam, in full glory reflected, now shines in the stream. 'Tis the star-spangled banner, O long may it wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country, should leave us no more? Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps, pollution, no refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave.
and the star-spangled banner and triumph doth wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. O thus be it ever when freemen shall stand between their loved home and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must, when our cause it is just, and this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Ultimately, the War of 1812 did not create a lot of change for either side beyond human casualties and material destruction. No land borders had changed, and historians viewed it as a war that simply maintained the status quo. Manifest Destiny. Colonist John O'Sullivan is cited with coining the term Manifest Destiny in an essay published in 1845, which declares the right and mandate to expand American territory on behalf of independence and freedom. The essay O'Sullivan wrote, entitled Annexation, was in favor of Texas annexation. He wrote that opponents to the Texas annexation were attempting to stop the fulfillment of our manifest destiny to overspread the continent allotted by Providence. Essentially, this was stating that the U.S. had a God-given right to claim the North American continent, and many citizens and presidents, including James K. Polk, held this sentiment to be true. The far-reaching, the boundless future will be the era of American greatness. In its magnificent domain of space and time, the nation of many nations is destined to manifest to mankind the excellence of divine principles, to establish on earth the noblest temple ever dedicated to the worship of the Most High, the sacred and the true. Its floor shall be a hemisphere, its roof the firmaments of the star-studded heavens, and its congregation a union of many republics, comprising hundreds of happy millions, calling, owning no man master, but governed by God's natural and moral law of equality, the law of brotherhood, of peace and goodwill amongst men. John O'Sullivan. The concept of manifest destiny inherently carried with it the notion that the U.S. should overtake Native American tribes and tribal lands. This philosophy, while not explicitly stated, generally referred to white Protestant males as the leaders and benefactors to this westward expansion.
Texas Independence and the Republic of Texas. Texas has a particularly interesting history, as it was originally inhabited by many Native American groups, then claimed by five different countries between the years 1519 and 1845. Spain first laid claim to areas of Texas and established presidios meant to spread Christianity throughout the land, as Spain felt they had a religious mandate to do so. Although Spain had claimed these lands, they weren't closely protected, and when the French arrived in the area in the mid-1600s, they claimed the Mississippi River Valley for France. This included parts of Texas, effectively splitting Spanish territory in Florida from the rest of its land further west. Spain understandably was upset and decided to take action against France, but by the time they found the